I have some sad news to report, though. One of our members has a tapeworm, and it's Paula Hudson. If you know anything about tapeworms, they tend to make you want to eat all the time. And that's what she did the entire 2 weeks we were gone, is eat. But it was great traveling with them and being back here with you this morning. Chapter 7 of the book of Acts is sometimes called the hinge of the book of Acts, because up until chapter 7, the preaching of the gospel was really confined to Jerusalem and the area right around Jerusalem. But after chapter 7, with the beginning of the persecution there in Acts chapter 8, of course, we see the spreading of the gospel going out to all those various places throughout the world, to every creature, the gospel will be preached. But before we get to Acts chapter 8, we've got to talk about Acts chapter 6, of course, and Acts chapter 7. I can't imagine the excitement there was in the church there in Jerusalem. As we come to the beginning of Acts chapter 6, there's a congregation of people, thousands of people, as the word of the gospel was spread throughout the people there in Jerusalem. The apostles were preaching the gospel from house to house in the temple area there. And so they were doing as the Lord had instructed them. You remember in Acts chapter 1, verse 4, the Lord had told them to stay in Jerusalem and wait for the promise of the Holy Spirit to come. And so they did that, and they stayed for a period of time after the Spirit fell upon them. And they had a good problem in Acts chapter 6, you might say, because of the growth of the church. But the problem was that there were some that were complaining. Look at Acts chapter 6, verse 1. And now in those days, when the number of disciples was multiplying, there arose a complaint against the Hebrews by the Hellenists because their widows were neglected in the daily distribution. Now, to fully understand the problem that we have here in this church, we need to understand the two groups involved here. We've got the Hebrews and we've got the Hellenists. Now, it may be different in your translation. In fact, in your translation, instead of Hebrew, you might have Hebraic Jews or native Hebrews. These were individuals who had been born and raised in Jerusalem or the surrounding area of Judea. People whose primary language would have been Hebrew or Aramaic. People who would have lived in that one particular place all their life. Been raised there. They didn't plan on traveling anywhere else. The word Hebrew, as described of people, comes up a couple other places in Scripture. It's found over in 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and then in Philippians chapter 3 as Paul described himself as a Hebrew among Hebrews, which is interesting when we talk about Paul a little bit later. But that's a designation of people that were native to the area. And then you've got the Hellenists, or you got the Hellenistic Jews, or the Grecians maybe in your text. These were Jews born and raised somewhere else outside of Judea, outside of Jerusalem. Their primary language would have been Greek, or their native tongue of the country in which they were raised in. They had traveled now. They are living in Jerusalem. The question comes up, why were there so many Hellenists, especially widows in Jerusalem? And the best way I can describe this is because Jerusalem to the Jews was like Florida is to Americans. You know, when you get ready to retire, a lot of people go to Florida and retire down there. But if you're a Jew, you want to retire somewhere close to Jerusalem. And so we find a lot of these Jews have traveled from these various places, these Hellenistic places, these Grecian Jews have come. They've come to Jerusalem. They've settled there. They're living there. They've become Christians. And now we've got this dispute there in the church concerning the distribution of the daily needs. Now, apparently the church of Jerusalem had already organized a program for feeding the needy, feeding widows. We don't know much about the program, but what we can gather from other passages in the New Testament is this. Only those widows who were in need were fed. The activity was done by the church, not farmed out to some other organization somewhere else. And there was to be an equal distribution of those things given to the widows. And that's where the problem comes up. The Grecian widows, the Hellenistic widows, were complaining that they were not getting the same portions as the Hebrew widows were getting. And so the apostles who were there in the church, not wanting to be burdened by trying to decide this matter, and that's something that's interesting to me. You've got the apostles there in the congregation. Instead of them deciding this once and for all for everybody, they said, well, you know, y'all take care of this. And I think that emphasizes the importance of spiritual matters as they relate to physical matters. For the apostles were about spiritual matters. And so they tell the church there, you all select some individuals. Look at verses 2 through 4. There, seek out from among you 7 men of good reputation, full of the Holy Spirit and wisdom, whom we may appoint over this business. So instead of them saying, well, here's what we're going to do. He made the church part of the solution. Find seven men that can oversee this here. And so the church does as instructed. And we know from verse 5, there's seven men that are appointed. Seven names are given there. But out of those seven, there's two that stand out, aren't there? There's two names that really stand out amongst the seven there. And one of those names is one we're going to talk about this morning here. And it is Stephen. What do we know about Stephen? I hope to talk about the other name next week as we talk about probably Philip. But Stephen. What do we know about Stephen is found in chapter 6 and 7 of the book of Acts. So let's see if we can't find out about this man, Stephen, here. Now, how is Stephen described? Well, he's described in various ways, isn't he? It says, first off, he's full of the Spirit. Full of the Spirit. And I think what we need to understand by someone who is full of the Spirit is someone who walks through the fruit of the Spirit. Galatians chapter 5. Someone who does the things that were found there in Galatians chapter 5. That's someone who's full of the Spirit. Someone who has all those characteristics there are the fruit of the Spirit found in Galatians chapter 5 there. So Stephen was one of those men. He was full of wisdom. What? Full of wisdom. It's interesting, the word wisdom in the Greek is found in four places in the book of Acts. Now, it's found in other places, certainly in the New Testament. But in the book of Acts, the word wisdom is only found in four places. And every time it's either referred to Stephen as being one who has wisdom or the way he spoke as one who had wisdom. Found in chapter 6 and 7 of the book of Acts as related to Stephen. So he was a man who had wisdom. Wisdom is putting knowledge into practice, and that's what Stephen had. He's a man full of faith, too, wasn't he? Man full of faith, described in verses 5 and 8. 1. Great faith in God. And he's also a man of power. Look at verse 8. And Stephen, full of faith and power, did great wonders and signs among the people. And so he stands out, doesn't he? Now, how did he get that power? The power was not that which he had naturally, of course. It's one that the apostles gave him, gave over to him that he might work these wonders and signs here. So here you've got Stephen as the man, we call the servant, the deacon, whatever you want to call him there, as he's referred to as one of the seven there. But Stephen stands out, doesn't he? Because Stephen wasn't just content on serving tables. Stephen wanted to preach. And so what we find out is that Stephen, the preacher, was one that was not afraid to confront those who had different opinions, certainly, about Christ and the gospel. And Stephen's ministry was to be amongst those synagogues of the Grecians, of the Greek-speaking Jews. Now again, up until this point, we see a lot of emphasis placed upon the Hebrews and the Jews there and the native to Jerusalem, what have you. The outreach consisted mainly of preaching from house to house or in the temple. But now Stephen is going to go to the synagogues there in Jerusalem. Now, look at the places that he goes. Look down here, verse 9 here? Yeah, verse 9. And then there arose some from what is called the synagogue of the freedmen, the Syrians, the Alexandrians, and those from Cilicia and Asia, disputing with Stephen. And so there's various places mentioned here associated with these synagogues that Stephen would go and that he would preach, and they would have these disputes seemingly here because of his preaching. Now, does everybody have their text, the word freedmen? Freedmen. Does anybody have the word libertine? Everybody's got freedmen. Oh, some of the old translation, I believe, I think it's the King James. Yeah, the King James Version uses the word libertines, not freedmen. Now, who exactly were these freedmen or these libertines? Well, there's question about that. The most common answer given is that these were individuals who were descendants of Jews who had been set free in Rome and now have traveled back, moved back to Jerusalem. Now, Pompey and his taking of various places took some Jews off back to Rome. They were freed when they got there, and they were referred to as the freedmen, seemingly from then on. There's another explanation, however, given, that the libertines or the freedmen were actually people from a place in northern Africa, not far from the old ancient city of Carthia. And again, we don't know for certain. We do know that they had their own synagogue, and there were other synagogues there that were made up of these various people from these places. There was a synagogue of the Syrians there, those from Libya, the Alexandrians from Egypt. There was a synagogue, seemingly, of those from Cilicia and Asia. Now, Paul was from Cilicia. We know this from, I think it's Acts chapter 22. We find out about that. And so here we've got these different synagogues that Stephen said, that's where I want to preach. And that's where he goes. And so he preaches in the synagogues. And there's the dispute that comes up, of course, about this man preaching this Christ. And they start to accuse him. Now look at what they accuse him of. We don't have time to read all this here, but verses 11 through 14, the accusations made against Stephen, the charges made against Stephen are this. First, he blasphemed Moses and God. He wanted to change Jewish customs. He blasphemed the law and the temple. And so these are the three charges made against Stephen. And that's pretty serious charges, aren't they? To blaspheme God. What I find interesting is that they say he blasphemed Moses and God. Not God and Moses, but he blasphemed Moses and God. He said something bad about the law in the temple. He wanted to change Jewish customs. And so the accusation didn't stop Stephen from preaching. Verse 15, and all who sat in the council looking steadfast at him saw his face as the face of an angel. You ever seen the face of an angel? You got kids, don't you? And Jamie's going, no. This is a lot about you. Yeah, faces of babies. Now, that's not what Stephen looked like. And don't read in there that he had a halo around his head. He just had the demeanor of and the calmness of, you might say, that the only best way that Luke could describe is that he had the face of an angel here. Warren Wiersbe in his commentary says it was as though God was saying, this man is not against Moses. He is like Moses. He is my faithful servant. Well, take that for whatever you want. But he's going to have to answer to the Sanhedrin of the charges made against him. And so Acts chapter 7 is the answer of Stephen to these charges. Acts chapter 7 is the longest recorded sermon. And I say sermon, and you'll see it is a sermon in the book of Acts. Now, the purpose of Stephen coming before the Sanhedrin was to answer the charges made against him. But what we're going to see in Acts chapter 7 is that Stephen's going to make charges against them. He's going to turn the tables against these religious leaders here of the Jews. He's going to show them to be what they really were instead of them trying to show everybody what he really was. And so let's see what he does here. Now, there's three topics I want to look at. First off, as Stephen delivers his indictment of the Jews. Now, remember the charges. He said things about, he blasphemed Moses and God. He tried to change the custom. He spoke against the law and the temple. Well, he's going to answer those charges, but he's going to do it in a way that indicts them. And really shows how foolish and how really unknowledgeable they are about God. So let's see if we can't see what he does here in his answering of the charge. First off, here's how he answers the charge. First off, he says, you know what? You people restricted God. You restricted God. Now, to a Jew, what was a temple? Was not the temple the place where the Jews met God? The symbol of God in Jerusalem was a temple. And so when you talked about the temple, if you said anything about the temple in any discouraging way, well, you're speaking blasphemy against God. But what Stephen is going to do is he's going to show them that, you know what, God has showed himself to our fathers in lots of different places outside of Jerusalem. Think about the places here. Look at down here in verse 12. He says, the God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia. All right, so God has appeared in Mesopotamia. How far is Mesopotamia from Jerusalem? Pretty good way, isn't it? Pretty good way. It's a distance. But God was down there. Well, what's God doing down there? I thought God's only hovered around the temple. Well, because God is everywhere. So he's down there in Mesopotamia. What's also interesting about the sermon in Acts chapter 7 is that Stephen adds some things to the stories of these people, the historical accuracy, the historical stories of these people that we talk about so often in the Old Testament that we don't find in the Old Testament. For instance, we don't have any record in the Old Testament about God appearing to Abraham when he's in Mesopotamia. Did you know that? What we have God appears to Abraham and Haran, Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 4. And so God appears first to Abraham in Mesopotamia. He said, you get out away from your family, away from your relatives, to a place I'm going to show you. Now, what we also find out is this, that Abraham only partially obeyed God. Because Abraham took his father with him, you remember? And then God appears to him again. Genesis chapter 12, get away from your father, get away from your relatives, and to a place I'm going to show you. So first off, Stephen says God appeared in Mesopotamia. Secondly, verse 9, and the patriarchs becoming envious sold Joseph into Egypt, but God was with him. So God's now down in Egypt, verse 9. Well, how did he get down there? Well, he got down there because God's everywhere, isn't he? And so he's in Mesopotamia. He's in Egypt. And look at verse 30. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of the fire in the bush in the wilderness of Mount Sinai. So we have him now in the wilderness, Mount Sinai. So God's been in Mesopotamia, God has been in Egypt, and God is in the wilderness. And you people, what you're actually doing is that you're restricting God. He's only here in Jerusalem, only in the temple. No, God's been in all these places. And in all these places, he's appeared to our fathers. And he said things to our fathers that are very important. To Abraham, to Joseph, and to Moses in a remote, barren place. He spoke to Moses. Now, I want you to look at verses 23 through 25 because here's some additional information that we don't have in the book of Exodus about Moses. Verse 23. Now, when he was 40 years old, that's Moses, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel, and seeing one of them suffer, he defended and avenged him who was oppressed and struck down the Egyptian. For he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand, but they did not understand. Now, you see that? How old was Moses when he finally led Israel out of Egypt? How old was he? 80 years old. At the age of 40, Moses thought himself to be what? Deliverer. He had in his mind that yeah, I'm the one to deliver these people out of here. But when he tries to deliver, you know, and does what he does here, there's wondering, well, hey, what's the deal with you? You know, I'm not going to follow you. And so 40 years later, after he'd been in the wilderness, after God had appeared to him in the wilderness, was Moses ready to lead the Israelites out of captivity. Now, we don't have that back in the book of Exodus. We got him from when he's expelled to 80. We don't have what is stated here in verses 23 through 25. So, the point is this. God has never confined himself to one place. Even in the dedication of the temple, 1 Kings chapter 8, as Solomon was cutting the ribbon, he says, you know what, this is a great building. There ain't nothing like it in the entire world, but I'm going to tell you something, it ain't big enough for God. And Paul does the same thing in Acts chapter 17. So these religious leaders, they were all about restricting God and his presence. Secondly, they rejected the prophets. They rejected the prophets. This was something that we see throughout the Old Testament story. You know anything about the prophets? They weren't popular people, were they? You think about Elijah. Was he popular? Absolutely not. Elisha? No. Jeremiah, absolutely not. You know, you go down the list. They were all hated. They were all rejected. They were all treated terribly. And the fact that Christ himself, Matthew chapter 23, verse 37, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophet and stones those who are sent to her. Luke chapter 13, verse 33, for it cannot be that a prophet should perish outside of Jerusalem. I challenge anyone to tell me, what foreign nation, what foreign people ever killed a prophet of God? And you can't find it. Can't find it. You know, we've been talking about Daniel, prophet of God. He wasn't treated bad by the Babylonians, by the Medes and Persians. They didn't kill him. Ezekiel, he would have been down in Babylon also. But when it comes to the Jews, they're the ones who treated the prophets bad. They're the ones who reject the prophets. And Christ in Matthew chapter 21 speaks a parable about the wicked husbandman. And again, it's all about the rejection of God's prophets and finally the Son. And we've already looked at about Moses there. Look, chapter 7, verse 35, at the age of 40, Moses was rejected. Who made you a ruler and a judge over us? You know, look at verse 38. Here's Moses. He's led the people out of Egypt here. And this is he who was in the congregation in the wilderness and with the angel who spoke to him at Mount Sinai with our fathers, and the one who received the living oracles to give to us, whom our fathers would not obey, but rejected in their hearts, they turned back to Egypt. And you're telling me that I have blasphemed Moses and God? No, you are the ones. Your fathers are the ones who blasphemed God. Reject the prophets. And finally, Stephen says, you have resisted the Spirit. Look down here at verse 51. You stiff-necked and uncircumcised in hearts and ears, you always resist the Holy Spirit as your fathers did, so do you. Which of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? And they killed those who foretold the coming of the Just One, of whom you now have become the betrayers and murderers who have received the law by the direction of angels and have not kept it. Resisted the Spirit. Ultimately, they did what? They killed whom? The very Christ that they said they've been looking for all these times. The very one that was to be the one who would deliver them in their hearts and minds from all sorts of terrible things. He's come. You have resisted the Spirit. You're stiff-necked. You're uncircumcised. Your heart's near. You have killed, murdered the very one who was the anointed one of God. So you tell me who was on trial in Acts chapter 7. It wasn't Stephen, was it? Stephen put those religious leaders on trial. And he told them really how despicable they really were. Now, we probably didn't need to be told that, did we? We'd already read our New Testament. We knew how despicable they were. But Stephen, standing before them, told them really what they were all about. And so why did they kill him? Why did they kill him? Well, you got to shut up the messenger, don't you? Can't let this guy loose out here in Jerusalem and speaking things like this. So we got to kill him. It's like John chapter 12. After Lazarus is raised from the dead, you would think that every Jew in Jerusalem would be convinced that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. But instead, you know what they want to do? They want to kill Lazarus. Why, you can't have him walking around as a living testimony to the power of Christ over death. So we've got to kill Stephen. We can't have this guy out here, you know, in our synagogues preaching this kind of stuff. And so we know that it ends up there in chapter 6 at the end. I'm sorry, chapter 7 at the end. That Stephen is killed. And there's one individual, of course, whose name comes to us there in verse 58. He'll become very prominent in the book of Acts. The name Saul, later becomes Paul. The persecutor and prosecutor becomes the preacher. And I dare say he never forgot what he witnessed that day as Stephen stood before the Sanhedrin. All right, any questions or comments? We are out of time. Appreciate your attention. Appreciate Doug taking class last week. Good things about it. All right, we'll